Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema.
Coming to you from beautiful Bixby Knowles, California.
But that's not the name of a city, though.
Well,
it's the name of a neighborhood. Yeah. How am our setup is all weird today, and now I don't know how far away I should be from this microphone.
You're fine.
Am I fine?
Yeah.
Everything's new and different.
I know. And you don't, like change.
I sound okay, yeah?
Yeah.
Like not too loud?
Am I?
Not too...
Registering?
Can you?
Yes, I am. Okay.
I hear you.
All right, good. That's what matters.
Linoleum Knife, as I said.
A podcast of the cinema.
Yes.
I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap and a film critic on What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
My name is Pistachio Disguisey.
I should never have told you that.
It's my new favorite thing.
From a movie we have not seen yet.
I've never seen that movie.
No, me neither.
Dana Carvey's Master of Disguise from the year 2002.
Something like that.
Yeah. His name in that film is Pistachio Disguisey. That's the best.
You're Dave White.
I'm a hiatus film critic for linoleum-knife.com.
Right.
Soon to return.
Yes. Any day now.
Not any day now, but when the book is finished and when other projects are accomplished,
when the moon is in the seventh house,
everyone just be patient and wait, and it's all going to be great again.
That's great.
Bixby Knowles is not a town; it's a neighborhood.
It's an area
in Long Beach.
Correct.
It's so nice in this house.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so nice in this house. We're in the middle of another heat wave. Like, I'm hoping the last one.
Of the year.
I'm hoping it's the last one of the year. It is still only mid-October, and it could happen again.
Mm.
I know. But if it happens again, we're coming back down here.
It hit the triple digits this weekend. It's pretty unbearable, especially for people like us who live in a non-air-conditioned apartment.
So we got up and we went to breakfast with our wonderful friend Chris, who lives here in Long Beach. And then we said, oh, by the way.
We're camping out at your house all day.
We're staying at your house all day where the air conditioning is. He does air conditioning right. It's like 65 degrees in this house. This is perfect.
It's very nice.
It's almost as good as the cold room
at the Academy
Library, which is my new dream home.
Yes.
It's an archival room that I've been inside where the temperature is always 53 degrees.
Yeah.
And it's like dehumidified.
Mm.
It's dry.
It's a dry cold.
53 degrees. It's perfect. And in lieu of that, we're staying in this house all day.
Till the sun goes down.
We were smart enough to bring all this podcasting equipment with us, too.
Yes. Lucky us.
And so,
lucky you. Lucky everybody.
Yeah. I'm just feeling so much more energetic.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
It invigorates me to be cold.
Yeah. It keeps the corpuscles moving.
I'm like I'm made of ice inside.
Well, you were born in New Hampshire.
And I need... That doesn't matter.
I think in this case it does.
I don't know that it does, really. Just because I was born there as a baby. And I went through, a dozen winters there?
Mm-hmm. I think they branded themselves on you.
Maybe. I mean, gulpy, gulp, gulp. I think that that was not me, by the way, that did the gulpy gulp.
No, because you're not a ventriloquist.
I think that I don't know what I was talking about.
I don't
anymore.
Either. You felt the need to scold me, and then your own train.
I'm made of ice inside, and yet I have a lot of oils.
Sebums.
A lot of greases and sebums. And when it gets too hot, I become a giant puddle of grease, like melted grease on the ground, like a pond made of lard.
There's a rainbow on you when the light hits.
There's an oil slick.
I could drop a match on you, it would catch fire.
I don't respond well to temperatures over 75 degrees.
Right.
It's bad.
Which is why you lived in Texas when I met you, and now we're in California.
Right.
Because nothing makes any sense.
No.
All right, this is fascinating, but I have a second round of thoughts about The Walk.
Are we going to talk about that first? Or yeah. Are we going to talk about Chantal Ackerman first?
Well, we'll get to Chantal Ackerman, but I wanted to. Here's the thing about The Walk that kind of struck me this week as something that's sort of in its favor. The notion of 3D movies, from the moment that they were introduced to the public, was the idea that they were somehow immersive and interactive. Like, if you go all the way back to the very first mainstream 3D feature, Buona Devil, do you remember what the ads were?
A lion in your lap or something like
that? Yeah, a lion in your lap, a lover in your arms.
Right.
The notion being that unlike the usual movies that were two-dimensional and at a distance, that this was somehow going to envelop you inside of it and you were going to be part of it. Which, of course, is not the case. I mean, you know,
right.
Nobody ever tries to advertise theater that way, heaven knows. And why should movies be any more interactive than that? And, you know, even the best 3D movies, like let's say Avatar, for instance, you do get immersed in that world and you forget that you are viewing something sort of artificial. You know, it sucks you into it and makes you feel like you're in it. But it doesn't make you feel like you're part of the movie per se. And one of the things that a lot of 3D movies do is have sequences where characters fly, whether on their own, you know, steam or on the back of something else or whatever. And it feels realistic, but obviously since none of us can fly, we have to sort of take the movie's word for it and whatever.
Okay.
I think what what The Walk does is really make you feel like you are Philippe Petit and you are out on that wire and you are doing the walk yourself. And I know you have issues with that for various reasons. Mm-hmm. We discussed that last week. Mm-hmm. But I will say, as a technical achievement, The Walk fulfills what 3D movies have promised for the better part of the last 60 years in a way that I don't know another film has really done. In terms of making it first person and making you, the audience member, feel like you are engaged in the same activity as the person in the movie is doing.
Oh, I felt like I was on that wire. Yeah. That's for sure.
So it's still a flawed film.
I wanted to cry.
Yeah. It's still a...
I may have wept a little bit to myself privately.
It's still a flawed film. There are still issues with it. But I will say in that...
The flaws are that it made me freak out.
Well, that too. But I mean, like the writing, there's things... We picked it apart last week.
Well, yeah.
But I want to give it credit that I think that it really does kind of... Even in more so in a way than like something like Soarin' Over California at Disneyland does. You know...
Don't you mean California Adventure?
The park is California Adventure. The attraction is Soarin' Over California.
No. I didn't go on that either.
Really? You've never been?
No.
Okay.
No, because you told me about it, and I was like, no, I'm not,
no, thanks.
I'm not doing that.
I like to call it Soarin' Kierkegaard Over California.
Of course you do.
Anyway, you know, again, that's a thing that sort of, you know, makes you feel like you're flying over, you know, various and sundry landmarks or whatever. But yeah, I think that The Walk...
By the city of pants is what...
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I will say, for whatever is wrong with it, The Walk is really great at creating an immersive cinematic experience.
It opens wide this week.
Yeah.
You go and panic attack yourself.
And if you're going to go see it, I really do recommend that you see it in 3D IMAX. Like, go for the full sachet, as they would say on Mirrorball.
Y'all know who you are.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
So, yeah, if this is not your thing, don't do it. Absolutely. Okay. No. So then, yes, also this week, the big news was that Chantal Ackerman passed away.
She
ended her life at the age of 65, which was kind of shocking that she was that young, but you know,
she was 12 when she made Jean Dielman,
apparently. So yeah. And I have to say, I am not super versed on Ackerman's work. I really just know her iconic Jean Dielman, like the film that, for which she's best known, but a film that to this day feels revolutionary. As somebody, I read one of the obits I read, they quoted somebody who said that overnight she completely changed the way that movies tell stories.
Yes.
And I'd say even for people who had been big fans of, say, Antonioni in the 60s, where, you know, these movies were supposedly not much happens and it's all very kind of internalized, she really took that to the next level and used that method of storytelling to say something about character and about gender roles and about the world's expectations of women. It is a landmark feminist film and one that it is truly unlike anything else you've ever seen.
Jonas Mekas and Andy Warhol had
demonstrated
extremely long takes, mm-hmm. Before, but
not in the service.
Not in the way that she did.
Yeah.
And not only did she push things forward formally, but she gave, I think, the world feminist film that encompassed more than just ideology. Sure. And so when I see Jean Dielman, like now even, mm-hmm. it is so demanding and so
rigorous.
But it's also the kind of movie that, and I talk about this so much, it's a cliche now. It's like a bingo card.
Are you about to compare her to Bresson?
No.
Oh.
I am not.
Okay.
But that the really long take, the slow, long film that, the movie that's about nothing, that everyone talks, they talk about that.
Sure.
Know? This movie's not about anything. And it always really is about something.
Of course.
I feel like those movies allow me the space to think my thoughts in ways that a film like, for example, Pan does not. And
well, yeah, you always point out the thing lately where movies are wall-to-wall noise.
Sound and noise and movement and yelling and
they don't let up for a second, lest your attention be diverted.
There's not a second of silence. The score or the song soundtrack is just booming over everything all the time. The Intern was like that.
Really?
Yeah, The Intern never stopped making noises. And I kept noticing it. I kept noticing that every spare second was filled with, you know, who is she? Who is that? I don't even know if she had any songs in the soundtrack, but who's the one that sings, I'm not going to write you a love song?
Whatever. Oh, Sarah Bareilles.
Yeah, a song by her. What's the other song? I want to, something about you be brave or some dumb thing like that.
Oh, I want to say.
Yeah. Like, it's all songs like that.
Right,
yes. And so I watch movies like that and I just think, could you stop singing at me?
But the thing is,
for
I think
3 seconds.
I think if you have been raised by movies like that, or that that's the norm for you, you watch something like Jean Dielman and you don't know what to make of it. You think, what's with all this quiet? Why is this woman sitting at a table chopping potatoes for 10 minutes? Like, I can't take it. You know?
All right.
And you have to sort of allow yourself to, a thing that I love about a movie when it's done right is that it makes me meet it. It makes me discover what its rhythm is and just go with it. You know, a movie like Scent of Green Papaya or something where I just have to, like, throw out my preconceived notions about narrative and about, you know, filmmaking language. Just be like, okay, you're in charge here. You know what you're doing, so I'm just going to follow your lead. You know, last year at Marienbad, something like that.
Kurt? Lane, make the kid watch Jean Dujardin.
It might be a little early for
what,
her.
What, she's a grown woman?
She's like 11 or 12.
No, she's more than 12.
Might be a little early.
She's more than 12.
No, I don't think so. I don't think she's a teenager yet.
She's 17 by now.
No, she's not that old yet.
Make that kid watch
She'll
that
get
movie.
To it. She'll get to it.
Everyone said, as a family.
Now, if you want to see Jean Dielman, Hulu has made all of the Chantal Akerman films available for free for a couple of weeks.
Not all of them, but the ones they have.
The ones they have.
I want to see the shopping mall one.
I know.
I've never seen the shopping mall
one. Me neither.
Yeah.
That one's not available, unfortunately. Not from Hulu, anyway.
A musical set in the shopping mall.
Yeah, called Golden 80s. But Jean Dielman is one of them. If you're going to watch Jean Dielman at home, though, turn off the lights.
And your phone.
Turn off your phones. Like, you cannot be distracted in this movie. You cannot have a second screen experience, as AMC likes to do with their
Get
TV shows.
Get comfortable. Have your snacks within reach.
Settle in.
Don't.
Settle move. In and be ensconced in this movie. One of the other ones that Hulu is showing is one that I really need to see, which is sort of her big... Because she was a lesbian, by the way. We haven't mentioned
it. I didn't know
that.
We
buried the lead there.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, but she has a film called Je tue il elle. Me, you, him, her.
Right.
That was considered something, like, you know, I mean, I think it came out like in the late 60s, early 70s. So it was sort of the lesbian movie for quite a while.
Oh, really?
For a lot of people, you know. So yeah, that's that one I've also heard cited quite a bit. So yeah, I need to see that one. But so yeah, so she was a very important filmmaker, and she passed away this week in the midst of an ongoing conversation about the role of women in film and why aren't there more women directors. And as Meryl Streep pointed out this week, why aren't there more female film critics? And she has a point. I don't know why she's picking on Rotten Tomatoes.
I think Meryl Streep thinks that Rotten Tomatoes creates film critics in a giant laboratory somewhere.
Or that there are hundreds of female film critics who have applied to Rotten Tomatoes and they've said, no.
No, no, woman.
Yes, not interested. That's not how it works, Meryl Streep.
I mean,
Streep.
I don't... was there a larger quote?
No, that's the whole thing.
That's the
I
whole
read
quote,
the whole thing.
It's, the whole quote.
I mean, she went through and counted the critics on Rotten Tomatoes.
I understand that she did that.
And then she blames Rotten Tomatoes for that.
Do it's we like, think she actually blames Rotten Tomatoes, or was this quote like contextualized in a weird way?
She
can't be so dumb that she thinks that Rotten Tomatoes is responsible
is in charge of all this.
For this.
Based on what I read, it sounds like that's what she's saying. I will give her the benefit of the doubt. She's a Yaley. Although, you know, Matt Damon went to Harvard. So,
did George W. Bush.
That's true.
He went to Yale, too.
Anyway, yes, Meryl Streep, there need to be more film critics, female film critics. Absolutely no question. Not Rotten Tomatoes' fault. Let's be clear on that.
Does she think that Rotten Tomatoes needs to only allow an equivalent number of men to be represented?
No,
I... Like, here we have all the female film critics. What were there, like 200 or something,
something
like that?
And then there were 760 men or something.
175 or something like that. And then does she think that the selection process for guys should be...
Scaled back.
Scaled way, way, way back? Or does she actually believe that they build film critics?
I don't
like out of human genomes.
No, I don't think she builds them, but I think she thinks that there's some that the application process somehow favors male critics, whereas the reality is just that there are tons more male film critics and there should be more female film critics, and for whatever reasons, maybe because women don't have the oppressive need that men do of jamming their opinions into everybody's face all the time. I don't know. I myself have brought two female film critics onto the staff of the Wrap. I'm happy about that. I would like to do more.
You yourself have saved.
No, I'm just, I'm trying to help my little corner of the world where I can.
I'm still applauding you.
Shut up. I could do more, but that's
you
where we are.
You could do more right now. Why haven't you gotten yourself a female co-host for this podcast?
Yes, get rid of you to establish parity. Speaking of feminist film criticism, by the way, our latest Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife.
Oh, yeah, we did one of those.
About Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. But
then we did it stupidly because we did it after the last show.
Yeah, we released it on a Monday, and it's been kind of crickety so far. But now we're telling you about it so that you can all rush to your computer.
Terrible at promoting
and
ourselves.
And PayPal us $1.99 at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know that you want that commentary and what email you want me to send it to, and we'll get it right out to
you. It's super cheap, and that's a good commentary.
It is.
Linoleum Knife. knife presents more linoleum knife.
One of the things that I discovered in doing the research, Howard Hawks, who directed Gentlemen for Blondes, made a lot of war pictures, made a lot of westerns, was discovered or sort of was reclassified as an auteur in the 1950s by, you know, the French, the Cahiers du Cinéma gang.
Right.
You know, and boy, did they not know what to make of Gentlemen for Blondes.
Well, yeah.
And subsequent generations of male film critics did not know what to make of Gentlemen for Blondes, and it really took feminist and queer film theory people to get that movie and understand what it's really about, to place it in the context of Hawks' work. And so just to go to the Academy Library and read all these old books and, you know, articles about the film and to see its evolution over the years of people giving it its rightful place as something beyond just mere, like, oh, candy, you know.
Right.
That's because of feminist film critics. Molly Haskell, you know, people like that really kind of came in through and said, no, this movie's about more than you think it is.
Yes.
Not a huge week this week.
Pan.
Nobody wanted to open opposite Pan? Is that Pan. The deal? Pan.
Pan. It sucks.
Oh, my God. It is my leading contender for the worst film of this year. Not walking out of Pan was one of my greatest acts of willpower this year. Not my strong suit, like, you know, put a plate of cookies in front of me, I will eat them. But right. staying seated during Pan
was work.
Was yes.
Yes.
I was really like being in control of things and like, nope, not gonna walk out. I want to walk out, but I'm not going to walk out.
Uh-huh.
Sit through this entire dreadful thing.
It is an example of the thing we were just talking about, the wall-to-wall noise.
Yes. It's an example of so many things we don't like in contemporary films.
I don't know how many producers there were for this film, how many people meddled in it, but it feels like it has been meddled with a lot.
Well,
like,
it started
passed with around from suit to suit who got their chance to be like, no, let's make it be like this.
It started with a screenplay from the guy who wrote one of the Ice Age movies. So I don't know.
That's fantastic. I
don't know that this was ever like this pure thing that then got sullied by, you know, commerce. I think it was kind of sullied from the get-go. Why don't you explain what it's about?
I don't remember. It's been like 3 days since I've seen it.
It's a prequel to Peter Pan because we needed that. We really needed a Muppet Babies as to, well, how people got to Neverland and what's happening. And
turns out Cirque du Soleil dives through your roof.
Yes.
Swoops you up into a pirate ship that's in the sky.
When you are in World War II London.
And takes you to Neverland, yes. Where you begin to work in a mine.
After singing Smells Like Teen Spirit.
While you sing Smells Like Teen Spirit, and then Blitzkrieg Bop.
Right.
And then you are punished for being bad after one day, and then you...
And Blackbeard
pushes you off the plank of the skyship, and then you fall, and you learn you can fly.
Because it turns out you're the chosen one.
You're the chosen one. And then you meet Tiger Lily.
And her, Hook, who doesn't have a hook yet.
Tiger Lily's multi-ethnic gang of people
surrounding the one white lady
who dress in feathers and beads and straps and colors and epaulets and all the
yarn.
Yeah, a lot of yarn. And
there's a destiny.
Hook is your friend. And that's Garrett Hedlund.
Right, and he's like Han Solo as performed by James Coburn or something. I don't know what the heck.
Then you have to fight Blackbeard.
And in the other dimension where the fairies are hiding.
Right. So.
Oh, God.
It's nonsensical. It goes in 13 different directions at once. Every 5 minutes.
It's shrill and irritating. I will give it this.
The kid is fine.
The kid is fine.
The kid's fine. The kid, as I watched it, I noticed that because everything is a green screen, the kid is a pretty effective green screen actor. Mm. He can react emotionally to nothing.
Well, that's what the kids are all having to learn how to do now.
Yeah.
He is going to be the son of Calista Flockhart on the new Supergirl series.
Supergirl.
So he's getting work. Greg Berlanti, who is doing all the TV superheroes now, is one of the producers of Pan. So oh, he's one of the people who put the stink on this thing.
I see.
It's directed by Joe Wright.
Who should know better.
Who should know better, although I'm not a giant fan of his. I've seen more.
And this is where I think that it got taken away from him, because generally I find his films to be competent and entertaining. And I feel like this is one of those times where either people came along and said, no, we know what's better here. We have things to sell. And we're going to do it.
But then why do you hire him?
Other
I mean,
ways.
Like, you know, when you look at the Marvel movies, they've gone out of their way to not go with anybody who's got too firm a point of view, or to fire them if they have hired them, like, you know, Edgar Wright. If this movie was just meant to be this sort of colossal global entertainment machine, which after its crappy opening weekend here, it is not going to be that.
Right.
Then why get Joe Wright, who, even though I don't like a lot of his films, at least is a director of an echelon who has things he wants to do and he wants to do them his way.
Right.
You know, I'm going to make Anna Karenina inside a music box,
right.
You know. So, yeah, it just seems strange that they wouldn't just get some hacky go-along-to-get-along guy to make this movie then. Anyway, it's the worst. Hugh Jackman is terrible.
The performances are nonstop shouting.
I mean, Rooney Mara, for as miscast as she is as a white girl playing Tiger Lily, is at least not playing to the third mezzanine.
Right.
Unlike, she and the kid are the only ones in the movie who are not doing that.
Right.
You know, Garrett Hedlund.
What's the kid's name? Levi?
Levi Miller, I
something,
think.
Yeah.
That guy from Four Lions, even. Like, they're just big, big, big. And it's, ugh. This movie's...
Is that who that is?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, Smee. It's an ugly movie. I don't know why people are talking about it. That, oh, at least it's visually.
Here's what I mean.
It is hideous, I think.
There's a lot of really cool production design going on. A lot of cool, like, set stuff and costumes.
The stuff that
like
is
that.
Neat seems borrowed from somewhere else.
Lots of details.
The pirate ships in space seem like they're right out of Baron Munchausen.
Right. But what I'm saying is a lot of attention has and a lot of care has gone into detailing this film. And then something happened along the way that it all became a giant visual mush.
Yeah, it's cluttered and milky and it's either super, super drab, as I said in my review, like you're watching a period movie about everyone's got syphilis, or it's so colorful that there are literal rainbows bouncing around the screen.
Yes.
It's all too much, as the Beatles would say.
The musical sequences are bizarre, and then they just stop.
And they stop, yeah. They just sort of feel like somebody saw Moulin Rouge once. You know, they don't they don't play into a larger idea, and they're abandoned. They do the two numbers in a row, and then never again does anybody burst into song. And they occur after they have firmly established that this movie is set in the 1940s.
Right.
Hate it!
It made us very upset.
I'm post-verbal about Pan. I will now do an interpretive dance on how much I hate this movie.
Steve Jobs comes out.
Steve Jobs opened
limited.
In New York and L.A. this weekend.
Two or three cities.
Just New York and L.A.
Just New York and L.A.
Yeah, but...
Next week wide.
Next week wide, yeah. And it apparently had a very...
Strong,
yeah, like 156,000 per screen or something like that. A lot.
Great. That's great for it.
Well,
I want people to see a Danny Boyle movie.
Sure.
You know, it's not that he's some kind of underdog.
I was going to say, he's got an Oscar.
I know.
He's not going anywhere.
But I like him. I've always enjoyed his films. I think he's a really energetic director. I think the cinematographers he works with. They always make films that are really beautiful looking to
if
me.
If you didn't see Trance, a movie that got
trounced
on.
They trounced Trance.
You're right. See Trance. It's so fun and smart and unpredictable.
I had
and
a great time.
Great to look at and sexy and
we
all
were in
the
minority,
things.
Though.
Yeah.
Critics didn't like it. Audiences stayed away. Maybe we're idiots.
No. I don't know why more straight guys aren't excited about a movie in which Rosario Dawson's private areas are a plot point.
They are a plot point. It's true. I don't think frontal nudity of Rosario Dawson is necessarily a reason to see a film, but
it can't hurt.
I guess you're right. Frontal nudity of anyone makes sure. a film more appealing, I guess.
I don't know about anyone, but you know.
Anyone.
Okay, fine.
Anyone.
Anne Ramsey?
Yes.
Okay. You should see Trance, is what we're saying. And then Steve Jobs, you should see too, although I didn't like it as much as I like Trance.
This is a better film than the one with Ashton Kutcher's bare feet.
Yes. Now, it's also better than Pirates of Silicon Valley. Remember that one?
Nope.
The TNT movie with Anthony Michael Hall as Steve Jobs.
Oh, yeah, that.
No. As Bill Gates, yes. And Noah Wiley as Steve Jobs.
Right. Yeah, I didn't watch that.
I did not see the documentary that just came out about Jobs.
If this were not my job, I wouldn't have seen either of these films. I would have probably eventually gone to see this because I like Danny Boyle so much. But this subject matter, Steve Jobs, mm-hmm. as a human,
yeah,
I don't find his life especially interesting.
No, it's weird how it's become this passion play that they keep making
knock on Chris's door
over and over again. I don't know what that was.
Let me go see.
Oh, all right. We'll be right back. We're not used to the sounds of the suburbs. We didn't know what that was.
It turned out to just be the poltergeist.
Yes.
That lives in the house.
Yes. So anyway, why are there so many Steve Jobs movies? What makes him so interesting?
Well, I mean, the cult of Apple products is, you know, still very strong.
Right, but it's not
I think people sort of revere him somehow for this stuff.
Yeah, but it's weird because
he did change things.
No, definitely.
He changed the world in a very significant way.
Yeah, even though he never invented anything.
Right.
You know, which this movie addresses. And I mean, it's funny though, because when you think about, like, say, the people who are Disney fanatics, you know, they might revere Walt Disney, but it wasn't until recent years that you would start seeing any kind of portraits of him that were remotely warty, you know,
right?
That would talk about, you know, that he named names in front of HUAC or whatever,
right?
But Steve Jobs, like, yeah, he has this weird sort of cult of personality, while at the same time everyone acknowledges, yeah, he was kind of a jerk and he should have acknowledged his daughter. And
the
you know,
films don't suggest that he's kind of a jerk.
No, he's an utter
jerk. The films
jerk.
Suggest that he was a fairly reprehensible human being.
Yeah.
And yet everyone still thinks he's great.
Yeah.
It's the part that I don't quite get.
Yeah, me neither. So Aaron Sorkin is the screenwriter here, and what he has done is, rather than tell the more traditional, you know, birth to death biopic that, say, the Ashton Kutcher one does, or at least, you know, he's starting him in college or whatever, he picks three discrete moments in Jobs' life as a prism by which we are meant to view all of him.
Right.
The Macintosh launch in 1984.
Yes.
The launch of Next in 1990.
Yeah.
1988.
Yeah.
Sorry, 1988, which was when Jobs had left Apple and was trying to start his own company. And then the iMac.
The same year as Kylie Minogue's I Should Be So Lucky. It was a more significant contribution to humankind, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then in 1998, the launch of the iMac. And because of this structure, it
did you say 98 or 88?
98.
For the iMac.
98.
Okay, 98.
Because of
You're
this,
correct.
Yes. Because of this structure, it sort of artificially imposes upon each of these product launches, which I'm sure were no doubt very dramatic in and of themselves and
yes.
had a lot of stakes.
Right.
These confrontational discussions with
everyone
in his life.
All at once.
Yeah.
Like they all just.
Like everybody hovers backstage to like talk to Steve Jobs
it's
about
it.
Like
it's like they all have a tracking device that suddenly pops up.
Steve's having a product launch.
Here he is.
We got to go talk about our stuff.
He's in one place. He's in an enclosed space. You can go get him right now.
You're going to find him in that green room.
Everybody come along. Hop on.
It's a little contrived. And my thing was, I felt like I saw these three great scenes, but I didn't feel like I'd seen a complete narrative. I don't feel like I had a complete arc. I don't feel like, even if we're just meant to know certain things about Jobs, I didn't feel like I had seen an entire story. I felt like these are great pieces. Like, I love what you've got so far, Aaron and Danny. Can't wait to see the rest of the movie. And there is no rest of the movie. That's it.
I don't know that I agree with you. I think that as a character study, it's complete. I think it is, like you just said, imposed on these events.
Yeah.
In a way that makes it feel maybe even less tied to reality than the Ashton Kutcher film. Because Aaron Sorkin, because he has a way of writing that makes every single person in his world speak like
Aaron Sorkin.
I do not have a problem with this. I am a huge fan of Gilmore Girls. Amy Sherman-Palladino does the exact same thing. Everyone sounds like Amy Sherman-Palladino in a Gilmore Girls episode.
But she creates distinct characters.
Distinct characters, yes, but so does this film. And so, but that doesn't mean that when they open their mouths, they're talking like a person might talk.
Well, yes.
You know, they're talking like, you know, rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat. And right. So that is a thing that I really like. I'm a fan of Aaron Sorkin's nonstop talking. And I really feel like he and Danny Boyle complement each other well. You need a person who's really visually assertive to take Aaron Sorkin's aesthetic.
Logorrhea.
Which is walking down a hallway and talking.
Which they literally do eight times in this movie.
The internet is a series of tubes. And this film is a series of hallways. Or rooms, big rooms, where people walk across the room back and forth.
And I mean, the Aaron Sorkin of people walking in hallways is enough of an acknowledged trope that Sorkin himself did it on 30 Rock once.
Yes.
Like, he knows that we point this out. He understands that it's a joke now, and he's still doing it.
Yeah, and it's a thing but you know what? I like it. I like how he does it. I like the way his dialogue moves.
I watched all three seasons of Newsroom.
I like the way Danny Boyle's films move. So together, they help each other.
I see your point. And ultimately, I do recommend this movie. I do think people should see it.
Exactly.
The dialogue is fun. The performances are terrific. You know, Michael Fassbender can be completely magnetic while still being repulsive.
Yes.
Which is what this role calls for. Kate Winslet is great in the sort of...
As his foil.
In what could have just sort of been the sort of second banana. She is very much... They are sparring throughout.
The assistant who doesn't let him get away with anything.
Yeah. The one person whose opinion he actually kind of will listen to. Seth Rogen, I think, this movie pushes him into very... he's done other dramatic roles, but I think this really kind of establishes him
Take this waltz.
Yeah.
He was Michelle Williams'
husband.
Sort of sad husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think this movie kind of puts him on the map as somebody who is really versatile in doing both comedy and drama. He holds his own against Fassbender, heaven knows, and they've got a really powerful scene together toward the end. So, there's nothing in this movie that I don't like. I just wanted more of it because it left me feeling like I had just seen snippets and not a whole thing. You obviously, I think... You saw it differently. But even with my qualms about what left me unsatisfied, I still think it's absolutely worth seeing.
Yeah. I don't actually care about Steve Jobs.
No.
But this film
But I wanted to leave with more of an idea of what this movie wanted me to think about Steve Jobs, and I didn't get that.
Geniuses are pains in the ass.
The end.
Basically, yeah.
We both watched Electric Boogaloo, The Untold Story.
Oh, we're not going to talk about Taxi?
Oh, right. Sorry, I totally forgot about that. We'll get to Electric
Boogaloo. The best film of the week.
Well,
you just calm down.
Okay, next to Pan and Steve Jobs, I guess, but yes. Jafar Panahi's Taxi.
I'm not having this from you.
You know what? I get to disagree with you about this, and you don't get to automatically love everything this guy does just because of the circumstances under which he makes them.
Man.
He is not beyond criticism. He's not. I'm sorry. So Jafar Panahi's Taxi is the latest film from Jafar Panahi, who is ostensibly not supposed to be making movies. He has been banned by the Iranian government from making movies. And yet, this is the third film he's had released in the United States since being forbidden from making
movies.
That's
right.
We should all have such curfew going on. You know, I don't know why we're worried about the Iranian nuclear program. They can't even stop Jafar Panahi from making a movie every year. Get it together, people.
Okay, so here's what happens.
He's on Instagram.
We know he's on Instagram because when on our Linoleum Cast Instagram account, that is the name of our Instagram account.
Yes.
By the way.
Yes. Also our Twitter name.
On the Linoleum Cast account, we took a picture of ourselves standing in front of the poster for the movie. We went to see it at the Lemley Royal out in Santa Monica on Friday afternoon. And we posted it to the account. And the first comment is a smiley face emoji from Jafar Panahi. I didn't know he was on Instagram.
I did not either.
It didn't occur to me to go look him up on Instagram. I got to say, I was a little stoked He emojied us. Yeah. We got emojied by Jafar Panahi.
Maybe he has a Vine account. Who knows?
He's on Snapchat.
Yeah. The government's doing such a bang-up job keeping him from making movies. I'm sure he's periscoping right now.
All right. So, brilliant filmmaker, Jafar Panahi. I'm just going to say that at the get-go here. Has been banned from making films by Iran. For the first couple of years of this banishment, he was under house arrest. And so the first film he made while under house arrest is called This Is Not a Film. And it is deeply frustrating and sorrowful, to watch. Because you've got a guy who cannot leave his own home. And who's defiantly going to make a movie in his own home, a documentary about himself.
Yeah.
It was smuggled out of Iran on a USB stick in a cake.
Right. And premiered to the Cannes Film
Festival. The best thing in the world. Then, in 2012, 2013, he made Closed Curtain.
Right.
Which sort of does a little bit of what this film does. It mixes his real life circumstances with a fictional narrative of, a man who cannot leave his home.
Mm-hmm.
This one, he's no longer under house arrest, but he's still banned from making films. This one, Jafar Panahi himself gets in a cab and pretends to be a cab driver all day. And picks up people with a camera mounted on the fuzzy dashboard of his car.
But the movie tells you pretty early on that
this isn't exactly real.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a lot
pretty
of
much scripted,
ambiguous, treatment of reality here.
Yeah. Like his other films are cited
by character after character.
By character after character. Clearly, there
plot points from earlier films are also
recycled
by people who do not discuss the films.
Yes,
but they're mimicking actions of people from his earlier films.
Right. There's a moment in which they pick up somebody from an accident who's bleeding and is, you know, he thinks he's dying and he records a last will that the other passenger records on his phone. And but then you start realizing, no, this is all scripted, and it's edited in a way to imply that it is, that it's in real time, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. That you're watching all of this through the dashboard camera, and that, you know, he drops one person off, you pick somebody else up, and that it all flows together. But I'm sure, obviously, that's not
right
how it was made. My beef with this movie is that I loved This Is Not a Film. I found that really powerful and really direct, talking about the situation he's in. This one, I kind of felt like he is doing this scripted treatment that is about the predicament that he's in, but in a rather heavy-handed way. Like, there's a long sequence where he picks up his niece from school. She has been given an assignment by a teacher to make a film in class. The teacher has provided the students with a long list of what renders a film unscreenable,
which is the Iranian government's basic list of same.
So the daughter, the niece rather, reads this long list and it's like, okay, yeah, all right, we get it. Yes, this is what the government said about your movies. This is why you can't make movies now. I don't like it when, as much as he's in a position to have a beef and to, you know, want to share with
have the, a beef.
Yes. Faggy beefy. He absolutely merits being angry at his situation about the political climate that has put him in the position that he's in now, that he has to make these movies on the sly and he can't credit anybody and, you know, they have to be snuck out of the country and all that stuff. Yes, I take away none of that. But that doesn't absolve him of these kind of Jeremiads that are supposed to be cloaked in drama. Like, either make a movie where you complain about the Iranian government, which he's done, but then don't make a fictional film, but then throw in this character whose only purpose is to be this mouthpiece for this stuff. It's clunky dramatically, and it feels, it's beneath him, frankly. He's a better director than that. That's my problem with this movie.
Okay, so that character, that little girl, mm-hmm. She's delightful.
She is sweet.
And yes. she steals every moment she's in.
She's darling.
And I fully disagree with you about it being clunky. I think this is a lighter touch film from him than we've seen in the past. There's a lot in the movie that's quite funny, intentionally so.
Mm-hmm.
It moves in a fast way. It doesn't stumble.
No, it doesn't drag. And there's a guy with six fingers in the movie.
And there's a man with six fingers in the movie. I do not believe it's heavy-handed. I believe it is absolutely the right film for him to be making right now. I think this is, you know, he's the only guy in world cinema currently that we know of, at least, mm-hmm. who is operating under the circumstances that he has been, you know, given. And he, within that box, he is doing imaginative, inventive, clever, you know, very sly, outfoxy sort of, you know, work. And
well, that he's doing work at all, yes.
I believe no. I believe that formally in the this film that we are talking about, mm-hmm. It is as exciting as anything he's done in the past.
Okay, but stuff that he's done in the past, when he was making films that were about the you know, how people live in Iran, mm-hmm. and what it's like to live in this, you know, religious government. But generally with a certain level of metaphor.
Yes and no. You know, have you seen The Circle?
I have not.
The Circle is pointed and direct. The Circle is the most harrowing and fearful film, and there's no metaphor going on. It's, I mean, yes, a little bit, but in general, The Circle is, oh, woman? Guess what? you better behave. That's you know, it's about the plight of women in the country. And
I just my take for me on this was, it just felt to me like, between all the self-referential stuff where people are talking about his movies or reenacting his movies, and then the kid with the list of censorship stuff, it was like, oh God, all right, we get it, Jafar Panahi.
What happens though is that she comes along and gives all the rules, the rules, the rules, the rules, obey the rules or your film doesn't exist. And then the woman, and then the lawyer comes in the car.
Right.
And she is, you know, what, 3, 4, 5 times the age of this child. And she is operating in the same space, more or less, that Jafar Panahi is. Yes. And, like, he asks her directly, haven't they stripped you of your
law license
by this point for, you know, working with these people that the government is against? And she's like, well, yes.
Not officially.
But they haven't sent me any legal notice yet, so I'm just going to keep doing it. Which I really feel those two women in the car at the same time, the younger one and the older one, are this great balance of what, you know, the straitjacket and the, yeah, well, inside this straitjacket, I'm going to wiggle around a whole lot.
But then what does the kid say after the woman gets out of the car?
I forget. What does she say?
The kid is talking about how, like, the things in the movie can't be too real or can't be too depressing.
Right, right.
And then the woman gets out of the car and she's like, well, I want to keep all that in, but it's kind of real and kind of depressing. So I don't know. It's like, oh, we get it. I kind of feel like, again, I haven't seen as many of his films as you have, but this just...
No, you haven't. That's why I'm right.
It felt heavy-handed to me. I mean, I would say... Definitely go see, dig up This Is Not a Film. This one.
This is one of the best films I've seen this year. And here's my one sort of caveat.
What's that?
For viewers. If you ain't seen the old ones, it won't make as much sense. Because there are direct... visual allusions to earlier films that are never cited. You just have to know. And that you'll still enjoy the film. Like, we had a friend with us who had never seen a single Jafar Panahi film, didn't know who he was at all, and who still enjoyed this. But after the fact, we explained, you know, okay, this is from The White Balloon, and this is from Crimson Gold, and this is from...
Offside,
you know. So, you know, occasionally they do address his films directly by name, and sometimes they don't. So if you don't know his earlier work, you'll miss some stuff.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it's a fantastic movie.
I mean, see it. It's great that he's still working, that he's getting his stuff out in the world, but... I'm not as inclined to just automatically think that everything he does is awesome just because he's doing this under duress.
Uh-huh. That's what I've just done.
Yes.
Automatically mm-hmm. given him a pass.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
You walked into this movie knowing it was going to be great.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Yep.
Because I can't be trusted.
I didn't mean you in particular. I mean,
yes, you did, actually. You meant me, Dave White. That's what you meant. I know you very well. Let's continue on to Electric Boogaloo.
Let's. The Untold Story of Canon Films, which just came out on DVD, which our DVD arrived while I was in Venice, and Dave was nice enough to wait for me to watch it.
Wasn't I?
Yes.
Yeah.
My darling.
Yes.
Waited till I came home so we could see it. It's a lot of fun. It is directed by the guy who made Not Quite Hollywood, which is a really fun documentary about Australian exploitation cinema. And also, I think, what is it, The Machete Maidens of Moratow or something? It's about Filipino exploitation films. Canon Films, for those who don't know.
Cuckoo Bananas.
They were started by a pair of Israeli cousins, Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus. And Menachem Golan had managed to be a fairly successful Israeli filmmaker. I think one of the first really sort of successful Israeli filmmakers. But, you know, grew up on movies and had big Hollywood dreams. And so he and his cousin bought this struggling company, Canon Films, and that was mainly just sort of doing, like, you know, naked lady movies, I think. And they started out, there, one of their first big successes was an action movie about the raid on Entebbe. Of course, Golan directed one of our favorite films, the 1980 musical The Apple, which we did a commentary on. And, you know, they really tried to invade the studio system and you know, become major Hollywood players. And they were very, you know, Yoram especially, great salesman, you know, would go to the Cannes Film Festival every year and, you know, promise all of these movies, and the ones that actually got foreign sales, you know, they would then make them. you know,
we got a title.
Exactly.
We just sold it.
We have a poster.
Now we have now to we come up with a movie.
Exactly.
Right.
And so, you know, these are the, this is the studio that basically created Chuck Norris. This is the studio that created ninjas. And the,
well, they brought ninjas to the United States.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what I mean. Ninjas already existed, but they cinematically created ninjas to a for a Western audience. You know, they gave us Breakin', and of course Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, where this title comes from. And it's just an interesting look at this attempt to be a studio and what went right, and then all the things that went wrong, and how, you know, the mistakes they made. Like, you know, they went from making a lot of cheap movies.
All of them.
Yeah. They were making a lot of cheap movies, some of which would do okay, to then sinking, for them, a lot of money, but not enough money, because both of them are cheap and crappy, and that was part of why they flopped, Superman 4 and Masters of the Universe. I would have loved to know more about their crazy art house wing.
Yeah.
Because these guys, while they were making, you know, Invasion USA and, you know, Sylvia Christel movies and stuff, they also made Godard's King Lear, mm-hmm. John Cassavetes' Love Streams, Robert Altman's Fool for Love, Poacazzi, you know, several...
Shy People.
Shy People,
yep.
Runaway Train, which was nominated for some Oscars, yep. Several Franco Zeffirelli opera films. And they actually, Zeffirelli's in the movie talking about how they were the greatest producers he ever worked for. Because I'm sure they didn't, they were probably sufficiently cowed by Zeffirelli to not right. boss him around much. And so, you know, he just got to do what he wanted. So yeah, they're just these fascinating figures in film history. And the movie has a lot of fun clips and cool interviews and... It's
cool
a lot of
interviews with about 300 people.
Yeah, and with a lot of the people that you would want them to dig up. You know, they found they talked to Michael Dudikoff from the American Ninja movies. They talked to Lucinda Dickey, who was in both the Breakin' movies and Ninja 3: The Domination, where she was an aerobics instructor who was possessed by the ghost of a ninja.
Catherine Mary Stewart from The Apple,
right. There's a whole DVD extra of people doing their Menachem Golan impersonations.
She looks at the camera and says, "The apple was going to be their Tommy." And then she looks at the camera. She's like, "See what happened?" Yeah.
Yes, she has a good sense of humor about all that stuff. Yeah, I found it really, you know, I think if you are a fan of kind of the odder side of 80s movies, you know, it's a movie you'll get a kick out of. So yeah, it's worth
it. It's a lot of fun to watch.
Definitely.
Especially if you like, you know, if you like garbage the way we do.
Indeed. Speaking of which.
Oh God.
Thanks to our friends at the Flophouse podcast. We were introduced to.
We're not actually friends with the guys from the Flophouse podcast, but we listen to the Flophouse.
Yes. Yeah. They don't know who we are, but nonetheless.
it's a one-sided relationship.
Absolutely.
We know who they are.
They recently reviewed a film called Fateful Findings, directed by one Neil Breen, a Vegas-based auteur. He's an architect by day, but apparently in his spare time he is a writer, director, producer, actor, who has made like three or four movies now.
Yes, they've screened them at CineFamily, and they show Fateful Findings with a fair degree of regularity at the New Art. At midnight.
And I think, at least, I think his first film was on Netflix for a while, which is sort of how he first kind of gained an internet following.
This is the first one I've seen.
Same here, yeah. I'd never seen one, but so we watched Fateful Findings. It's streaming on Amazon Prime.
I'm willing to see the other ones now. However, this was pretty hard
to deal with. I think Elliot Kalin on Flophouse said it best, where he said, Fateful Findings is like The Room if Tommy Wiseau didn't know anything about filmmaking.
Yeah.
Like, it really makes you appreciate the relative competence of somebody like Tommy Wiseau when you see a movie that's this just...
Although the ending here really does kick out the jams.
Well, yeah.
In a... It builds to an ending that is pretty flabbergasting, and I don't want to give it away, but it involves a mass suicide, and that's
of corrupt government and corporate officials.
And so, it's about a guy who is a famous and successful novelist. He's
also a hacker.
He's also a really next level computer hacker.
He has a magic rock that he found when he was a child. Yeah. That seems to protect him
from evil
and getting hit by a car.
He's constantly throwing his laptops on the ground, spilling coffee on them, smashing them.
He's got three on his desk at any given moment, and they're always pushing them off the
table intentionally, like trying to kill them. Although that's where all his hacking is going on. So if he loses them, he has to start over, right? I mean,
one would imagine. There's a lot of women in this movie who have been cast as his sort of romantic counterpart who clearly had it in their contract that closed mouth kissing was as far as they were going to go. Because this guy kind of looks like Howard Stern crossed with Neil Schoen from Journey, I guess. I don't even know how to describe him.
I don't think you should talk about Howard Stern or the guy from Journey disparagingly.
I'm trying to paint a visual picture here.
It's not a cute visual picture. You have to look. Let's not be mean about how this guy looks.
Okay. He is not simmering with charisma.
I have a monster face.
Oh, stop.
And
he is not flowing with charisma as an on-camera personality.
Okay, let's say that.
For sure. There's that.
I'd make out with Tommy Wiseau first.
Before Neil Breen?
Yeah.
If those are the choices, I suppose.
Yeah.
If we're playing Death is Not an Option, yes. So yeah, Fateful Findings. If you have Amazon Prime, you can stream it for free.
It is relevant in that he, much like Mr. Wiseau, wrote a lot of love scenes in the film for himself.
Yes.
So, anyway, y'all got to see this movie.
Yeah. We can barely do it justice.
It's damaged, and it apparently is part of an ongoing narrative concern of his, the idea of...
secrets.
Paranoia, secrets, corruption, that kind of stuff. Even though it's all very generically applied. There's nothing specific.
Yeah, he says over and over again that he's got all these government and corporate secrets about... What is it?
Corruption and hypocrisy.
Yeah. But that's it. Like, there's no... This is like Trial of Billy Jack level kind of unspecific paranoia.
And then 99 Homes opens wider this week.
Right. We talked about that.
We did.
Yeah.
Okay. But just letting you know.
Sure.
Yeah. The way that The Walk opens wide
right. this week, too. All right. So...
That's it. That's all the movies.
What's your DVD pick this week?
I wanted it to be The White Balloon. Jafar Panahi's late 90s, 97, 98 film, The White Balloon. It's not available on DVD anymore.
Huh.
And hasn't been for some time. It is on YouTube.
Huh.
You can watch the entire thing with English subtitles on YouTube. Someone has uploaded it. Go to YouTube and watch The White Balloon.
We'll post a link on Facebook.
You can, however, watch his other films on DVD. Crimson Gold.
The Circle.
The Circle. Offside.
This Is Not a Film?
This Is Not a Film. Any of those earlier narrative films before he got in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend all of them.
Offside.
But start with The White Balloon. Go to YouTube and watch The White Balloon.
Okay.
It's there. And until someone gets it together and puts it on DVD, that's fair game as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And I think Mr. Panahi would not mind. No. I think he's like, yeah, just check it see out. It. Yeah, just watch it. Yeah.
Mine is the 2003 Peter Pan that was directed by P.J. Hogan, which is a great Peter Pan movie that nobody talks about.
That nobody talks about, nobody saw.
That movie came out over 10 years ago, yeah. And it, you would think that maybe some, like, there'd be that generation of kids that saw it on cable and now they're in college and they don't. No, they no don't one ever either. Talks about this Peter Pan movie.
Yeah, like, and it's really good.
You know, why is Hocus Pocus still being discussed and no one talks about Peter Pan?
Right.
Yeah, it is, it's lovely, it's beautifully shot. Jason Isaacs is a great Captain Hook. The kid whose name I don't remember who plays Peter is really great. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie. I would say arguably the best live action Peter Pan adaptation.
Jeremy Sumpter is the young man who played Peter Pan.
I film. Very highly recommend it. And incidentally, since
Lynn Redgrave is in it,
Olivia Williams.
Yeah.
I'll be posting a link on Facebook. And just as a reminder, as we come skidding into the holiday season, the Amazon links that we post on Facebook, if you click on them when you go shopping on Facebook, even if you aren't buying the DVD that we link to, but just use that as sort of your portal into Amazon before you go shop for whatever it is you're going to go shop for, we get a kickback. And that helps the show.
Yeah.
So next time you are doing some shopping on Amazon, think to go to our...
Evil Amazon.
Yes, well, think to go to our Facebook page first. Click on one of the links and then go do your business. That would be great.
They are as bad as Walmart, and you know it.
Really?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. But they're inescapable.
I know.
Letters.
I got them. Hold, please.
We need to have, you know, wall-to-wall music, speaking of which. We have some sort of, like,
no.
Letters underscore.
No. Silences.
Silence is weird on a podcast.
No, it's not.
Dead air.
No. People need time to breathe.
No, I always think of Dave Vaness, my old station manager at WRVU at Vanderbilt, who we'd be listening to the radio, and whenever there'd be some sort of gap between songs, he would just go, dead air,
dead air.
Air. Dead air.
Who cares?
Dead air. Dead air.
Who cares? Who cares? Not me.
I do.
We make the rules here.
Just read a letter. Do it.
Okay. I'll do that right now.
If you're feeling sad.
Dear Professor Duralde and Dr. Freewheelin', what do films say about the greater culture? Nothing.
No,
absolutely nothing.
Not true.
Not just the current popular ones, although taken alone, I can see why many feel we are headed to hell in a handbasket, but as a whole, over time. A.O. Scott's piece in today's New York Times, in which he explores the state of snobbery, touches on the role of the critic. I enjoy your brand of criticism precisely because it seems devoid of snobbery and has more to do with identifying the difference between the good and the bad, as evidenced by the so bad it's good recurring theme in your body of work. This seems to be an excellent lens, mirror, or filter, or whatever, through which to engage the greater culture. So why are people stupid and not put critics in their proper place as cultural Sherpas? Signed, Handbasket Pilot from Ohio. P.S. Professor Duralde's impression of Paul Lynde from a July 2012 episode made me laugh so hard I peed.
Well, thanks, Handbasket.
I don't remember that episode.
I don't either.
I don't remember last week's episode.
Yeah, wow.
So...
Yeah, I know. I read the Scott piece this morning.
Me too.
I kind of like the idea of, you know, the snobbery, the word snob needs the kind of rehabilitation that, like, geek and nerd had, where it's descriptive without being a pejorative. And I think there's a difference between saying that you... that you only watch a certain kind of movie, you only like a certain kind of movie, As opposed to liking a movie that happens to be considered difficult or esoteric or whatever by a certain segment of the population.
Right.
You know, we're not raving about Chantal Ackerman's Jean Dielman, so you'll be impressed by how smart we are.
Right.
We're raving about Chantal Ackerman's Jean Dielman because we watch a lot of movies and we understand things about film language and we find it exciting in its own way by what it does, and we hope that you will too.
Right.
You know, it's not like, oh, it's this great movie. You probably won't like it. You know, that's snobbery.
It's kind of obscure. Yeah, you probably never heard of this
guy. It's a little challenging.
Yeah. It's probably not.
Maybe you don't want to. Yeah. That's snobbery. No, we like what we like, and we want to share it with the world.
And what we like is great.
Because we say. Tie a yellow ribbon on the old oak tree. I'm trying to think of hold music.
Okay, this is from Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Alonzo and Dave. Listening to the recent episode, I wanted to send you guys a few comments that were on my mind during the episode. Number one, Dave, your experience with the air conditioning troubles at the movie theater is pretty dead on with what I have to deal with on a regular basis. After working at a local dine-in theater for nearly a year, a theater that does serve breakfast like pancakes and French toast, lunch and dinner, I'm going to that theater. Dealing with other workers and managers who don't care at all about the customers can be really aggravating. Just the other day, I was helping a woman out of the box helping a woman out at the box office desk. She was dead set on using her AMC Rewards card for her ticket purchase, while I told her many times that this was not an AMC theater. The woman then stared at me with an evil glare, told me to screw myself, flung her arms, and ran out of the theater. I mean, if you were planning on using a gift card or any certificate of any sort, shouldn't you look up to see if the establishment will accept such items? That would be like using the Buffalo Wild Wings gift card we just got from wonderful listener
Cindy. Which we made a dent in it this week, thank you.
And taking it to, we made a giant dent in it.
Yeah, so taking it to Bennigan's.
Yeah. Yeah, you going to take it to TGI Fridays or Chili's?
Yeah.
No, you're not going to be dumb. Why be dumb?
What do you mean you won't take my McDonald's gift certificates here at the Olive Garden?
Number two, I also saw The Walk, The Martian, and Sicario over the past few days. Now, this guy goes to the movies.
Yes.
Although Sicario and The Martian were obviously the best of the bunch, I didn't hate The Walk as much as both of you did.
I didn't hate The Walk.
No, he's talking about me.
Yeah.
But it still wasn't very good.
Well, yeah.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt's accent and pretty much the entire screenplay was abysmal. Plus, the horrendous narrative framing device with Levitt was extremely obnoxious and spoon-fed the entire plot to the audience. It seemed throughout the film that Zemeckis didn't know if he wanted the tone to be more family-friendly or more adult, so it was really awkward to watch. Mm. I do agree with Alonzo that the final 40 minutes were pretty outstanding with the actual walk taking place.
Yeah.
Number three, while this wasn't on your most recent episode, I did want to ask you both a question regarding Straight Outta Compton and Dope. Two films that are both primarily targeted toward the African-American market, and one was a gigantic success, and the other fizzled after 2 weeks. I haven't seen Compton yet, but when it was first released, it sold out completely at the theater I work at. This was while Dope suffered to get even 10 people into a screening on its opening weekend. I have seen Dope, and I thought it was great fun, but what do you guys think of the night and day success of these two films? Was it due to the huge corporate names of the people involved with Compton versus the small independent nature of the latter? Hope you guys have a great rest of your week, Joe. Yes, that's exactly it.
Well, that's part of it. I think another part of it is the fact that Straight Outta Compton comes pre-sold by the band.
A cultural phenomenon that everyone knows about.
Yeah.
You know this story already. You know about NWA, you know what Straight Outta Compton means before you even go into the theater.
Exactly.
You know who Ice Cube is. You know who Dr. Dre is. You know who Eazy-E is. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, not that any movie that's based on a known quantity is an automatic hit, but it did have that.
It was a well-made film, too.
Yeah, but it had that going for it, whereas Dope is not an easy movie to explain in 25 words or less.
Or sell. It's about, you know, nerdy young kids who operate outside of cultural stereotype. Not a single star in the film, no one that you know. I think the most famous person in the movie is Chanel Iman. And do people recognize her who don't read Vogue? Probably not. So,
it's even a movie that's kind of making fun of tropes within the, like, black teenage inner city movie,
right.
You know, very intentionally. So yeah,
quite intentional.
Yeah, so it's harder to explain that.
Really weird tone throughout that treats serious, like, unhappy stuff like a joke.
Jocularly, it's weird. There were two people on my Facebook wall this weekend that mentioned being in line at a movie theater box office behind people who honestly had no idea what they were going to go see until they got to the window.
Yes.
And when you're dealing with those kind of people, and there are a lot of them, which is the easier movie to explain to them in 10 seconds? Straight Outta Compton or Dope?
Right.
Obviously Straight Outta Compton is. So I think, there were a lot of factors involved that just made that an easier sell. And you know, I mean, they were both critically acclaimed, but I mean, that's not necessarily a factor in this kind of thing.
Yeah. The funny thing is I went to see Dope on opening night, and... the theater was packed, but this is Los Angeles.
Well, yeah.
So.
And it's like that thing also where.
It may have been the one packed house that movie had during its entire run.
Like the handful of people who are enthusiastic to see it are really enthusiastic to see it, but everybody else is kind of, whatever, you know.
Right. All right, next one. 9 Fall Slow Cooker Faves.
I don't think you need to read that one, but thank you, Mr. Ross.
Some slow cooker recipes for you. Wait, let's see. What's in this? Pot roast.
Great.
Chicken and dumplings.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's the one right there. Pepper steak. Turkey chili. Ooh, pumpkin turkey chili. No.
I don't really know how you cook with pumpkin.
Here are the acceptable foods that pumpkin can be.
Pie,
bread, pancakes.
Mm.
That's all you really need to do with pumpkin.
Yeah.
You don't need to put pumpkin in anything else. We don't need to turn this into the next bacon.
Well, the thing is, I mean, a lot of stuff that says pumpkin spice is just means that there's, you know,
cinnamon and nutmeg
in it.
Right.
But pumpkin itself, I mean, it's a gourd, right? So, like,
right.
I mean, does it fall? Do you use it the way you would use, say, squash?
You could. Yeah. But yeah, the entire letter is a link to slow cooker recipes. Yes.
I don't know that it was only a letter for the show
sent it to me.
Well, just so that you could make me some foods. Not to read on the air.
I'm going to make you some foods.
Thank you.
Not today, but...
No,
you
know, too hot.
Too hot. Speaking of that, we're here at a stranger's house all afternoon. We need to order a pizza.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not a stranger's house. It's a friend's house.
Stranger to the podcast.
Yes. Not our usual...
The podcast people, the listeners have no idea.
They're baffled.
Although, you know what I'm going to do on the Linoleum Cast Instagram account? I'm going to take pictures of all the incredible art that Chris has in his house. We call this place Mocha Long Beach. Museum of Contemporary Art. The Mocha is a place in Los Angeles. We call this house Mocha LB.
Yes.
And there's a reason. You're gonna love all that because I'm fixing to take some Instagram shots of the badass art he has.
Did
in
you
this
get
house.
The permission from the homeowner first? From the collector? I see.
He doesn't have to know.
Ah,
he's locked up in the back room watching Empire.
Yeah,
he'll never
but
know
he
what
reads
we...
your Instagram.
Does he read Linoleum Cast Instagram?
Doesn't he?
Look, he'll be happy that we're showing off his amazing collection.
Fine. Read another letter.
What do you know, Matt? Mr. Severson.
Oh. Another list of 50 movies?
He was our date to Jafar Panahi's Taxi.
Yes. On the day he got married and didn't bother to mention it, to me, anyway.
Well, I thought he was already married. That's what he walked into the theater. He's like, got married today. I was like, I thought you were already married. You had a wedding. Yeah. He's like, yeah, but it wasn't.
He had a wedding the way we had a wedding.
We went to the courthouse today to get the papers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, do you want some popcorn? Like, he segued right into, do you want some popcorn? Like, no. I mean, yes, but no. Yeah. Dear Dave and Alonso, I just wanted to add a couple of suggestions for your listener, Dave, whose letter, the other Dave, the listener Dave.
Yes.
Whose letter you read on last week's podcast relating to realistic and diverse points of view regarding spirituality and or religion.
Oh, yeah.
There are two recent films I would recommend without hesitation, Of Gods and Men, Javier Beauvoir's 2010 film, based on a true incident involving Trappist monks living in a monastery in Algeria. I missed that one. I know it came.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
And I remember Sony Pictures Classics released it, and they sent me, I remember distinctly, they sent me an email with like 13 different screening options, and I thought, I don't have time. Like, I just don't have time. When violence breaks out in the village, the monks have to decide whether to flee or stay. The film takes its time, steadily building tension by contrasting the monks' cloistered existence with the encroaching civil war. It is a terrific... it's a terrific film, both formally rigorous...
Ooh.
Thanks, Matt Severson.
We have bingo.
And quietly profound. The Overnighters.
Oh, yeah.
A terrific 2014 documentary by director Jesse Moss about Pastor J. Reinke, whose Concordia Lutheran Church in Williston, North Dakota, ministered to the desperate men and families who flooded North Dakota on the promise of finding work during the state's oil boom, but once there realized that there were few jobs available, which left many people homeless. Reinke's pastoral work upset many in the local community who didn't appreciate his making a place for people who were bringing crime and other unwanted behavior into their once peaceful existence. It is best to see this film without knowing much more about it. The story takes a few sharp turns before it's over. I know what those are. Not necessarily to the film's benefit, but I was most impressed with the way the film documents one man's crisis of conscience. The other films I would recommend that were not included in what we discussed were Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Sure.
Rossellini's Europa 51.
Okay.
Fred Zinnemann's A Nun's Story.
Yeah, okay.
Satyajit Ray's Devi, also known as The Goddess.
Mm-hmm.
Bergman's Winter Light. Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev. Ken Russell's The Devils. Frederick Wiseman's Essene. Do you know there's a new Frederick Wiseman movie coming out?
Yeah, it was at Venice. I didn't get a chance to see it.
I'm excited. It's coming. The poster was up at the Royal.
Oh, cool.
Well, the digital poster. But
yes.
The one that goes over. It's so weird, those digital posters.
I know. We had to stand in front of the thing waiting for
and
the...
And you don't have enough time to look at the whole poster. Like, I just want to look at the poster and look at what it's like, how it's designed. And I want to read the little credits and not just be like, oh, title, boom, next one. Slow down the digital posters. Lemley. Thanks. And Krzysztof Kieslowski.
Wait, which Frederick Wiseman movie is he recommending?
Essene.
Oh, Essene. Okay.
Yeah. And Krzysztof Kieslowski's The Decalogue.
Yeah.
Tell ya. Matt is next level art film, bro.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you, if there were if there were boxing matches that you had, like, these two people are going to box, and their strength is in how much they know about
world cinema.
World cinema. He would be the Muhammad Ali of that. Like, seriously.
Yeah, it's funny, because sometimes we'll be talking about movies at Outfest, and somebody's like, oh, you've seen everything. And I'm like, no.
And you're like texting Matt,
no,
can you tell me more about
not.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Believe me, I know people who have seen way more than me.
Although
then when Matt makes his list of here's stuff I haven't gotten around to seeing, it's like, what?
I would also recommend director Paul Schrader's excellent 1972 book, Transcendental Style in Film, Ozu, Bresson, and Dreyer. Well worth reading.
Yeah.
Keep up the great work, as always.
Thanks, Matt.
That's it. I'm done with the letters.
Oh, fine. So yeah, just as to let you know again, Gentlemen for Blondes is now available.
Buy it.
Yes.
$1.99.
It's a commentary track that I think came out really well, and it's a very fun movie to talk about.
I'm usually sort of annoyed with our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes.
Oh,
after,
say that.
Well, after I finish it, I just think, oh, I forgot to say this, and I should have said this, and I wish I had thought to include this other thing, and like I'm always Monday morning quarterbacking
sure,
myself.
Sure, no, I know the feeling.
But this one I feel pretty good about.
Yeah, we covered it real well. Shall we announce what our next one is? At the moment, it's only available at the end of this commentary where we announce it. So I don't know.
Let's wait another week.
Okay,
then.
Yeah. If you really want to know what our next one's going to be, you have to buy this one. So again, that's $1.99. PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And just let us know where we're sending it and specify which one you want. Because in addition to Gentlemen for Blondes, we also have special commentary track episodes for What's Up Doc, The Poseidon Adventure, Two for the Road, Clue, Josie and the Pussycats, Santa Claus, and White Christmas. And I left one out. And The Apple.
And
the
Apple.
The aforementioned The Apple. As always, we thank Blue for our wonderful theme music, and we urge you to check out our friends online. Go to ChristyLemire.com, check out the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, the Schmoes Know, the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Matt and Gray, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast, the Joel Ryan thing, the Sewers of Paris, Film Spotting SVU, the Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes and leave us a review there. It does help people find the show. Who was kind enough to leave us reviews this week? I sent them to you. We had some really wonderful ones.
Hang on. Wiz Monkey 98.
Okay.
Says we're better than cereal.
Well, all right. S-E-R-I-L, not breakfast cereal. Who else?
We ain't better than... Captain
Crunch.
We ain't better than Captain Crunch.
No. Who else?
Tucker Wonders.
Okay.
Tucker Wonders. Megan Maggot.
Well, thanks all three of you.
You're this week's Blood Pepsi.
Yes.
Megan Maggot.
Thank you for the kind reviews. It does help people find the show. You can also stream us at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave us positive feedback there. And of course, join our Facebook page on Facebook, the Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can also join our Linoleum Knife group page and talk to other fans of the show about movies and about the show and about whatever else you feel like. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel where we've been posting some of our oldest episodes. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at LinoleumCast, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or whatever else you'd like to share with us. We're getting into a very interesting time of year with lots of releases, and some of them are pretty good, and awardsy stuff and whatever else. Big news from LA Film Critics this week. We are honoring Anne V. Coates with our Career Achievement Award. She won an Oscar for editing Lawrence of Arabia. She also edited Out of Sight and Aaron Brockovich and The Elephant Man and most recently 50 Shades of Grey. But she is a titan in the industry, and we're thrilled to be presenting her with a Career Achievement Award. Anything else?
Who's doing it? Are you doing it?
I don't know. I think Wade Major should, because he actually wrote this really great email kind of breaking down her career and explaining why she's important. And, I think he really nailed it and got a lot of people rallied behind her as this year's honoree. So
would you make sure, that this year you don't present to anybody important so that we can have more fun at the table?
We'll see who gets.
Because when we have to sit with, I know this is going to sound like such a terrible predicament, but when we have to sit with famous people, it really cramps my style.
You had fun sitting with Richard Linklater and Julie Delpy a couple years ago.
Okay, here's why.
Because Julie Delpy ate everything.
She's great. She
has a hearty appetite.
She cleaned her plate and then started eating Richard Linklater's food. And I was like, you're awesome.
Because a lot of times we get stuck with the actresses who don't touch the bread.
Yeah.
much less pass the butter.
And I will say that halfway through the event, when Kate Blanchett just sort of breezed in and sat at our table, that was kind of weird. Yeah. Like, I looked at her once, like the way you, when they tell you not to look at the sun.
you
and you're like, you can't help but look at it.
I was wondering why
once.
You had those two pieces of cardboard.
Oh, someone's ringing the doorbell.
So they are.
Why don't you get up and do that?
Why don't we just end the program?
And all right. Anyway, I don't like sitting with famous people, no matter, even if it is Kate Blanchett, and I'm scared to look at her more than once.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Okay. Goodbye.